Again, why would he do that? It simply alienates a major religious custom within the empire. On the other hand, public pagan temples still continued. Why didn't he close them down? There is evidence that he closed some of them. Most of them, though, continued throughout his reign. In fact, most of them will continue until the 380s, until finally paganism is outlawed. Again, I think you've got a man who's weighing his political opportunities, weighing what steps can I take, what steps can I not take. When we come back after the break, the final area of evidence I'd like to present is documentary evidence, in which Eusebius quotes statements from Constantine, in which I think he indicates clearly where his loyalties lie. Now, as I said, one can't read his mind through this. But I'm just asking the question, why would he do this politically? When a majority of the empire, only a small minority of the empire are professing Christians. Now, as I say, you can read the evidence different ways, but you have to explain all this. You have to explain the facts as they're presented for us. And when you're doing history, you're looking at causes, events, etc., and you seek that explanation which best accounts for most of the facts. There's going to be holes. There are holes here. But what accounts for most of this material? Okay, any questions before we break? We'll break for about 10 minutes. No. None. It's always the first day.
Okay, but is that documented before?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you've got Pliny, all the way back to Pliny. He talks about the meeting on a set day of the week. The Lord's Day was always known as the eighth day. There's a whole theology history associated with the eighth day. And the eighth day is the day after the seventh day. So it's the first day of the week. And the eighth day is tied in. A lot of the pre-Nicene theologians like Justin Martyr, Tertullian, Lactantius, Irenaeus are premillennial. And their reading of history, the 7 days of creation correspond to the 7,000 years of history. And when the Lord rests on the seventh day, that's the end of history typified. And that so the worship on the eighth day is really an experience of realized eschatology in which they are experiencing the rest of the age to come. So there's a whole theology that there's no way Seventh-day Baptists or Seventh-day Adventists have any foot to stand on in terms of arguing that the early church, as you saw in the letter to Diognetus, it typifies an attempt of the church in the mid second century, from that point on, to distance itself to some degree from Judaism. To some degree, to our hurt, because our faith is rooted in the Old Testament scriptures, and you can't understand parts of the New Testament without knowing that. But having said that, the worship on the first day of the week, or the eighth day, or the Lord's Day, is heavily emphasized, and it's not on the seventh day. No. I don't know what the Roman world did in terms of the days, out of the order of the days of the week. You've got a significant part of the empire that are slaves, so you can take off time whenever you want. They have to work all the time. But there is a rhythm. I mean, the seventh day is built, there's a rhythm of life. And for instance, when the French Revolution And I think the communists tried it too in the Russian Revolution, but then the French Revolution, they tried to go to 10 days. And it broke down pretty quickly, and they went back to the 7. So there is a rhythm. Did the Romans have that? I don't know that. But the Romans did not have a history of a seventh day, as far as I know.
Is the house church used a lot of lay preacher or even for the sacrament? Because they have like a very small group, like 60.
Yeah.
There can be many in that group.
There would be like Rome. There is a great study by a man named Peter Lampe, L-A-M-P-E, from something to Valentinus. It's a study of the growth of the church in Rome. I don't know how he's done it, but I've gone through it. I didn't pay attention to all of the data he was giving. He has identified about 60 house churches in Rome. He knows the streets where they are. It's quite remarkable. He's using archaeological and literary evidence. There is very little. Well, it depends on how you read the early centuries. But Ignatius of Antioch will say, do not celebrate the Lord's Supper without the bishop. Every local church had a bishop, one elder who came to the fore as a bishop. Well, that's in process in the second century. By the third century, you have a pretty well episcopal model. You do not, as far as I know, you don't have the lay celebration of the Lord's Supper in the patristic church. There may be some examples of it, but it basically is part of the role of the president, the one who presides. The word the president is the one Justin Martyr uses, who normally is an elder. An elder has been set apart.
When you mentioned about divorce, those criteria of divorcing a husband or murder, this is what he instilled or it had been?
No, it had. He instilled that. Divorce was fairly easy for a Roman male. Yeah, for a variety of other reasons. But this, again, is going against the grain. And all this stuff is countercultural. It's all going against Roman culture. But if you look at it from the point of view, if he believes he's a Christian, it makes sense. Please note what I'm not saying. I'm not saying he is indubitably a believer. And there are some anomalies in his career, as I've already mentioned, and we'll see when we get to looking at the Nicene Creed. Because he believes that the church can reconcile themselves to Arius. And so there's significant anomalies there. But in terms of what does he think he is, what does he see himself as, that's what I'm looking at. I don't think he's a political opportunist. Okay, it's 2:45. Why don't we break till 3 o'clock, and then we'll come back and we'll do the final hour till 4.
Apology of Justin Martyr, chapter 67 is a reference.
Okay.
Wikipedia calls that the first reference to Sunday as the Christian day of worship.
We were just discussing that. Dr. Hayden, I know this might be lengthy, but is there any study about when exactly the word or the idea of water regeneration and like you mentioned, Cyprian would have really literally thought what he was saying.
I think Cyprian's probably the first key figure.
Really?
Yeah.
Before that, if others would have used it, they would still see it more symbolically, like it's.
Irenaeus, I don't believe, would use that phrase. Now, Ignatius of Antioch talks about the Lord's Supper as the cup in there, the cup of immortality.
Ignatius.
Yeah. But I don't think the image of the idea of the water of regeneration is used part of
the. Did Salina ever use that type of language? That
Cyprian's one of the first. He's certainly the key figure in the Latin speaking tradition. There may be figures before him, but he's certainly the key figure for the Latins. Okay, let me pick up then, and now what I'm going to turn to is looking at documentary evidence. And I want to begin with a decree that Constantine issued in 324. And in the notes, again, the course pack that you have there, there is the page Constantinian Turning Point. And if you turn, for instance, to chapter 228, this was a public decree that Constantine issued in 324. 228. And you'll have to look at the top. It's in the little right-hand corner. There's a 229, and just before it is chapter 28. So you've got a text from Athanasius, and then you've got Constantine's oration to the Assembly of the Saints, and then you've got Eusebius, the life of Constantine. It says 229 in the corner. It'll be in the course path. You've got Athanasius, Constantine's oration to the Assembly of the Saints, and then you've got selections from Eusebius' The Life of Constantine. And this is 229 at the top. Okay? Okay, let me read there, 228. This is a decree he issued in 324, which I think indicates something of his own convictions about remolding Roman society along the culture along the lines of Christianity. And now, with such a massive impiety oppressing the human race and the Commonwealth in danger of being utterly destroyed. This is he's talking here about the Roman emperors and the impiety of the Roman emperors, and he's talking about the attack on the church by Diocletian. As if by the agency of some pestilential disease, and therefore needing powerful and effectual aid, what was the relief? What was the remedy which the divinity devised for these evils? And by divinity is meant the one who is alone and truly God, the possessor of almighty and eternal power. And surely it cannot be deemed arrogance in one who has received benefits from God to acknowledge them in the loftiest terms of praise. I myself, then, was the instrument whose services he chose and esteemed suited for the accomplishment of his will. And accordingly, beginning at the remote Britannic Ocean, and that is a reference to the year 306, when he was appointed the emperor in Britannia, and it's described there as the remote Britannic Ocean, because every Roman knew that beyond the British Isles, there was nothing. No land, no nothing. It was simply Oceanus. And you need to keep that in your mind, because we'll encounter that with Patrick. The Britannia and Ireland are the end of the world. Yeah, this is Constantine writing. Yeah, this is, and that's why it's important that what T.D. Barnes tries to do, and I think does so with a fair degree of of historical accuracy, he shows the reliability of Eusebius as a historian. He does that by showing that when Eusebius quotes documents that we have in other sources, either other texts or if we have an actual inscription, he is normally very accurate. In other words, if we can trust him when he quotes other sources, we can therefore trust him when he quotes sources to which we don't have other other access.
Had others questioned Eusebius's accuracy before?
Yep. Others, some have argued that Eusebius basically doctored the texts. And he doctored them to reflect a Christian ruler. Because as we'll see, Eusebius has it, Eusebius is in awe constantly. And we'll see that. And so Barnes' argument is that where we can check Eusebius, he's accurate in his quotations. And so it's unlikely then, it's not impossible, but it's unlikely, but we can't, in other words, we can trust him or we can't check him. Because where we can check him, he's accurate. I myself then was the instrument whose services he chose and esteemed suited for the accomplishment of his will. Accordingly, beginning at the remote Britannic Ocean, and the regions where, according to the law of nature, the sun sinks beneath the horizon, through the aid of divine power, I banished and utterly removed every form of evil which prevailed, in the hope that the human race, enlightened through my instrumentality, might be recalled to a due observance of the holy laws of God, and at the same time, our most blessed faith might prosper under the guidance of His almighty hand. Or again, look at the next text. This basically continues this. This text is another text that is a continuation of that text. I said, under the guidance of his hand, for I would desire never to be forgetful of the gratitude due to his grace. Believing, therefore, that this most excellent service has been confided to me as a special gift, and the word that is used there in the Greek is charisma, or charisma, which is interesting. I proceeded as far as the regions of the east, which being under the pressure of severe calamities, that's because the East was going through worse persecution, seemed to demand still more effectual remedies at my hands. At the same time, I am most certainly persuaded I myself owe my life, my every breath, in short, my very inmost and secret thoughts entirely to the favor of the Supreme God. And so, in other words, what he's emphasizing here is that the mission, he believes that God gave him a mission. When he was made emperor in Britannia, God gave him a mission to rid the empire of persecution, which he describes as a massive impiety, and so secure the safety of the empire. And he obviously viewed the attack on the church as undermining the Commonwealth, and God gave him a mission to basically Christianize the empire, in lack of a better word. A second text, which is over the page, it comes from Eusebius's Life of Constantine again, and this is 249, and it's the top of the next page, and unfortunately, it's just chapter 49, it should be book 2, chapter 49 there, and this is where he describes his thinking about his father and the other Roman emperors. The former emperors I've been accustomed to regard as those with whom I could have no sympathy on account of the savage cruelty of their character. Indeed, my father was the only one who uniformly practiced the duties of humanity and with admirable piety. And the word piety there is the Latin word pietas. It's a very, as a pagan word, it has the idea of the coinciding of an inner attitude towards life and the gods with your external actions. And obviously it's been taken over into Christian thought to mean the whole area of the inner life. Indeed, my father was the only one who uniformly practiced the duties of humanity and with admirable piety called for the blessing of God the Father on all his actions. And here he speaks of God the Father, which bespeaks a Christian framework. The other text did not say, just spoke in terms of God on all his actions, but the rest, these are the other emperors, on sound in mind. In other words, he's basically saying all these men were mentally disturbed, were more zealous of cruel than gentle measures, and this disposition they indulged without restraint, and thus persecuted the true doctrine. which is a reference to Christianity as the true teaching during the whole period of their reign. Nay, so violent did their malicious fury become that in the midst of a profound peace as regards both the religious and ordinary interests of men, they kindled, as it were, the flames of a civil war. In other words, the only recent emperor who meant anything to Constantine was his father. Now, one of the texts I haven't given you, but you can look at later, is the life of Constantine, 254 to 56. And in that text, he's even more critical of the Roman emperors who went before him. As far as he's concerned, all of the persecutors of the church have met their rightful end in an eternal hell. They were men, he says, who delighted in error at the shrines of falsehood. But the Roman state now to realize that Christianity was now the Roman emperor's religion. Your name, he said to God, I truly love, while I regard with reverence that power of which you have given abundant proofs of confirmation and increase of my faith. Those are two texts. A third text is this one. If you jump over a few pages towards the last page in the force, in this section of the force pack, just before we look at early monasticism. Constantine called by divine providence. This article, if you want to find this article, well, in the notes that have been handed out, you can actually see it, one of the footnotes. It'll be footnote
29.
Is it 29? Well, 29 is the is a later citing of it. The first sighting of it is found 25. Yeah, it's in the Studia Petrisca. They definitely have this in Calvin. I'm not sure if you have any volumes of that upstairs. In other words, C.D. Barnes is not the only author who argues this way. This guy, Paul Carestes, argues this way. And he cites this text where Constantine wrote to King Sapor of Persia. The Persians, as we've seen, were Rome's traditional enemy in the East. And Sapor had many Christians as subjects and hostages. Constantine wrote him the following way, that he should treat them well, since the Persians would have to answer to him for their well-being. And then he tells him this: I profess the most holy religion. I confess that as a disciple of the holy God, I observe this worship. With the power of this God on my side to help me, beginning at the boundaries of the ocean, that's a typical Roman geographical perspective on the world, I have gathered every nation, one after another, throughout the world to the certain hope of salvation. This God I worship, my army is direct dedicated to him, wears his sign on their shoulders, marching directly wherever the cause of justice summons them. I confess I honor this God with never dying remembrance. This God in the highest I contemplate with a pure and simple heart. Now, there is no reason politically, he's got nothing to gain politically by telling the king of Persia that, look, you've got Christians in your realm. You touch them, you'll have been answerable. Because I happen to worship the same God that they do, and the God that I worship, we have his sign is on our army standards, our banners, and this God who's given me their own empire. And you're in trouble if you touch these Christians. You can imagine today if President Bush were, I'm not sure who's ruling China currently, but if we're to tell the president of China, look, if you touch, I'm a Christian, and if you touch any of the Christians there, you're risking a really significant retaliation from me, militarily so. It's not going to win him. The critical issue is it doesn't help him politically within the empire. How is that a move of a political opportunist? And now, if you're not convinced, that's okay, but you have to explain the data. That's the issue. And the explanation is that this is all mere political opportunism. It just doesn't ring true to me. I am not saying the man didn't fool himself. Nor am I, please know what I'm also not saying, I'm not saying that God actually gave him the mission to Christianize the Roman Empire. I'm not saying either of those. But what I'm interested in trying to find out, how did he view himself? And how to explain historical data. It's a very important way, it's a very important issue in reading church history. Of finding an explanation for as much of the data as you can.
How did you explain it beforehand?
I didn't know it. That's the point. I didn't have this data. And I think a lot of the argumentation in favor of him as a political opportunist is really has never been confronted with this. A lot of the argumentation, you see, I argued from the effects of his reign. But as I began to realize that just didn't really cut it. You really have to grapple with these issues in terms of the actual data, how to explain them. Now, that this had a significant impact on the church is undoubted. Suddenly then, at one moment, comparatively speaking, the church is being persecuted. The next moment, actually Constantine had a retinue of bishops, who, for lack of a better word, basically hung around the imperial palace. And one can imagine how things went from overnight, you're now public enemy number one, the bishops, and now you're confidants of the emperor. And there was a man, and we'll come across him with the whole issue of Arianism, Eusebius of Nicomedia, who becomes known as a Cork bishop. A man who, if he had been arrested prior to Constantine, would have been executed for his faith. Although there's great questions about his faith because he's an Arian. But afterwards becomes a man who Constantine's asking his advice on public policy. And it's no wonder that some of this suddenly, the shift in the status of the church goes to the head of some figures, and one of them is Eusebius of Caesarea. And Eusebius of Caesarea is a very important figure in a number of ways. He is technically known, he's born around the year 270, and he dies in the year 339. He is an Origenist. He is devoted to the memory of Origen, sees him as a very significant figure who he wants to remember. He is known as the father of church history. I personally don't feel that's the best title to describe him. He certainly is a very important historian in the early church. I think Luke is the father of church history, not Eusebius, but be that as it may. We have a lot of material from the early centuries that we wouldn't have if Eusebius hadn't collected it and preserved it. Theologically, he is naive. And that, by the way, that's a good reading of him. Athanasius had a more heavier reading. He was a fuzzy-minded man who should have stuck to history instead of dabbling in theology. Because he comes out, his Trinitarian theology is at best confused. At worst, it's downright Arian. We'll look at that briefly when we come to Arianism. But what's important at this point in time is to recognize his development of a specific theology of history known as either a Eusebian theology of history or an imperial theology of history. And to put it in a graph form, for Eusebius, you have the Old Testament, which is a period sketched like so. There is a peak in the history of the church with the coming of Christ. A second peak is found here with the coming of Constantine. And the goal of history is beginning to be realized in a Christian Roman Empire. And what he does, and this is certainly not bad, and although it's a challenge, he reads history providentially. He reads the providence of God as having guided the empire to the point that now we have a Christian as a ruler. There would be a period of time in which this Christian Roman Empire would exist, and then there would be the consummation. When the empire fell, it was all over. And what you have here is the inability of a Christian author to envisage the church's existence without the empire. And the sort of political, legal marriage of church and state that Constantine is beginning to erect, Eusebius erects in theory. And this is a very potent mix, as we will see. And I want to look at two texts to illustrate this. The first text is a sermon he gave in 336 when he was in Constantinople. Oh, by the way, the one area that I didn't mention, and if you want to, the passage we've just been reading, you go back three pages, you'll find Oration and Aura of Constantine on the 30th anniversary of his reign. One thing I did not mention, another factor why I think Constantine is making a distinct break with the past, is he found a new city to be the center of his rule, which is Constantinople, and not Rome. And the reason why he found Constantinople is he claims that the old Rome is so besmirched with the blood of the saints that there's no way he could rule from that set of cities. And so he found Constantinople on the shores of the Hellespont, which is that body of water between the Black Sea and the Aegean Sea.